вечер. Всички мерси, че сте тук с нас. Чува ли се или... Чува се. Сега тази вечер лекцията на професор Деком ще бъде на английски, така че ще говорим на английски. Аз ще направя едно кратко представяне на английски, след което ще последва лекцията на професор Деком и след което въпроси също така на английски. От вас, отговори също така на английски. So it's a great pleasure for me to welcome Professor Vincent Decomp, who almost an year ago accepted the invitation of the Human and Social Studies Foundation and agreed to come to Sofia to give a public lecture and to participate in an academic seminar. Vincent Decomp is a professor at the School for Advanced Studies in the Social Studies, Social Sciences in Paris, so L'École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales. His rich academic career developed moving between different universities and different continents. The University of Nice, the University of Montreal, La Sorbonne, the American universities, Johns Hopkins in Baltimore and Emory in Atlanta. Where Decomp, in the United States, I mean, taught French literature and philosophy during a period of 10 years, so between 1983 and 1992. Among his first publications are his doctoral thesis, Le Platonisme, in 1971, L'Inconscient Malgré Lui, 1977, it is a philosophical clarification of Lacan's psychoanalysis, and Le Même et l'Autre, 45 ans de philosophie française, 1933-1978. This is the period of the French philosophy, which was investigated in this book. The book was published in 1979, and it was a philosophical overview of French philosophy, which introduced a lot of American and English-speaking academics to the contemporary French thought. In the 80s, Vincent Decomp oriented his research towards the analytical philosophy, whose approaches became one of his main critical tools. He published a lot of works inspired by this tradition, among which is La Denrée Mentale, whose English translation, Provision of the Mind, brought about large academic discussions with the participation of intellectuals like Rorty, Robert Brandom, and Charles Taylor. In the last years, the researches of Vincent Decomp are dedicated to the social philosophy and the practical philosophy, with a special emphasis on the problems of identity. I should mention a few important books in this field, Les Institutions du Sens, 1996, Le Complément du Sujet, 2004, Le Raisonnement de l'Ours, 2007, and Dernière Nouvelle du Moi, co-authored by Charles Larmore, 2008. His book, Le Complément du Sujet, has been awarded the big prize for philosophy of the French Academy. So the philosophical inspirations and provocations of Vincent Decomp are various. Aristotle, Wittgenstein and his students Geech and Anscombe, the French sociological and anthropological school, Durkheim, Marcel Mauss, Louis Dumont, the philosophers Cornelius Castoriadis and Charles Taylor. Despite the variety of these references, Decomp elaborates a consistent position of his own. He teaches us how to be philosopher, taking into account, on the one hand, what sociology and anthropology have taught us, and on the other hand, the acquirements of the philosophy of language. In the books and articles of Decomp, there is a thesis which seems important for his philosophical standpoint. The precedence of the objective spirit to the subjective spirit. Decomp reminds philosophers and social scientists something they often seem to forget, namely what philosophical reflection and scientific research owe to the social condition of man. I would like to mention just one aspect of Decomp's philosophy, which has been very important for me personally, but which is also important, I suppose, for Decomp himself. the systematic and penetrating critique of the political and practical philosophy of the subject, and in general, the critique of individualism in philosophy and social sciences. This critique proved to be particularly original and productive when Descombes decided to reevaluate such a major philosophical concept as the concept of subject in his book Le Complément du Sujet. After this brief and general presentation, I would like to withdraw and to give the floor to Professor Descombes for his lecture, Criteria for Collective Identity.
Thank you very much for your presentation. So, criteria for collective identities. Let me first draw a distinction between two kinds of identity: social identities, collective identities. I will argue that they are not on the same level from a conceptual point of view. I will argue that social identity is a dispensable piece of jargon, which we could replaced by other terms like a social image or label, whereas collective identity is a notion we need. And this is what I am trying to argue in this paper. What do we understand today when we are told that people worry about their social identities? I will take an example from the testimony of the Nobel Prize Amartya Sen in his book, Identity and Violence, published in 2006. Amartya Sen observed that in today's use of the term, having a social identity is a matter of sharing characteristics with other people. These shared characteristics constitute what is often called a shared identity. Then, and this is of course Amartya Sen's main point in his book, we should always attribute social identities in the plural. If having a social identity is sharing an attribute with others, then of course, speaking of my identity in the singular would be simply wrong. Nobody can have just one social identity, since there is no just one way each of us can claim to share characteristics with other people. And from this premise, Amartya Sen concludes rightly that identity politics, grounding my political commitment on my social identities, is just a mystification. And he gives an illustration by drawing his self-portrait. He writes, I quote, "I can be," so it's Sen speaking, "I can be at the same time an Asian, an Indian citizen, an American or British resident, an economist, an author, a strong believer in secularism, etc., etc." The list of all the attributes that Sen shares with others could go on almost indefinitely, since Sen, or anybody else for that matter, can be described in various respects: continent of origin, citizenship, ancestry, country of residence, profession, hobbies, social status, religious affiliations, etc. So the point is clear, nobody can belong to just one single social category. And this is precisely where we should ask whether this way of ascribing individuals to social categories and giving them social identities has any explanatory value. If we look more closely at these examples of social identities, we see that each of them is given by an adjective: an Asian, an Indian citizen, an American resident, an author, a strong believer in secularism, etc. And all these qualifications are indefinite. They all take the indefinite article: a citizen, an American resident. And since they are indefinite, they do not point to just one and the same individual. Amartya Sen is just one Asian among so many Asians, one Indian citizen among so many Indian citizens, one author among so many authors. If you learn that there is one Indian citizen who has published a book There is no reason to conclude that Amartya Sen has published a book, because although he has the two attributes in his identity. So calling identities these attributes is very puzzling, because these identities have no identifying power. They do not identify one person. So we don't see why they should be called identities. Now, you could say that these social identities are not identities because they identify one and the same individual, but because they identify these social categories: citizenship, ethnic origin, religion, etc. And I would say this is a step in the right direction. These identities do not identify the individual. They are supposed to identify something else. But what do they identify? If you look again at Sen's list of social identities, you see that they give very heterogeneous groups. He writes, I quote, "We do belong to many different groups in one way or another, and each of these collectivities can give a person a potentially important identity." Now, what do we call a group here? Being an Indian citizen is certainly belonging to a group. Such a membership is precisely what we call citizenship. On the other hand, being an author is also a ground for being classified with other people on the basis of having written books. But the social category of authors is not a group in the sense in which the Indian society is a group. We don't want to say that one is not yet an author until he has joined a professional guild of authors. The group of authors is nothing but a logical class defined by the attribute of having published a book. So being an author does not mean being a member of a community. One needs to distinguish between two kinds of membership: membership into logical or nominal classes, that is to say groups that are nothing but a way of defining a population between various categories for statistical purposes, and now membership into real groups such as a national state, India, or a university, Cambridge, or a church, or a political organization, etc. So only the second membership into a real group, raises the question of collective identity. And this will be my topic in what will follow. I will now concentrate on collective identity, leaving aside social identities. Let me introduce the question of collective identity by quoting a fragment by Blaise Pascal. And here is the translation in English I have found. "Time cures griefs and quarrels, for we change and are no longer the same persons. Neither the offender nor the offended are anymore themselves. It is like a nation which we have provoked, but meet again after two generations. They are still Frenchmen, but not the same." Maybe I read it in French because it's okay. So much beautiful, the style of Pascal. So in French it is, "Le temps guérit les douleurs et les querelles. Parce qu'on change, on n'est plus la même personne. Ni l'offensant, ni l'offensé ne sont plus eux-mêmes. C'est comme un peuple qu'on a irrité et qu'on reverrait après deux générations. Ce sont encore les Français, mais non les mêmes." So in this fragment, Pascal is rehearsing a familiar theme in moral literature. He is telling us about the changing character of our feelings. What seems to us so important at the present moment might be forgotten in a few years. So the theme is not original at all. But the way Pascal puts it is remarkable. In fact, he's reversing the traditional analogy between a human individual person and a group of people like a nation. We are familiar with the analogy between organism and group when we take the living body as a model for a group. But Pascal is doing the opposite. He's taking the nation as a model for the person. Meeting the same person a few years later is like meeting a people two generations later. That's the analogy. This way of framing the analogy raises two questions. First, a logical question. Pascal speaks of us meeting again the same nation. Now, how do we tell whether we are dealing with the same nation as before or with a new nation? How do we individuate a nation? That's the first logical question. We need a principle of individuation. That is to say, we need to have criteria of identity for concrete historical groups such as nations, cities, colleges, hospitals, orchestra, football teams, etc. Second, there is a metaphysical question. What is the difference between making some Frenchmen angry, that's the example of Pascal, and making a whole nation angry? Are we using a figure of speech when we personify a nation and represent this nation as having a psychological life, as being able to remember or forget events, as having a collective memory, a collective imagination, as well as collective emotions associated with memories and anticipations? So I will say a few words about the two questions. First, the logical point. In the French text, Pascal says that after a few generations, we meet the same nation. And he says, ce sont les Français. They are the Frenchmen. They are not just Frenchmen, they are the Frenchmen. So the question is, how do we meet the same nation, the Frenchmen, when all the people we meet are different? That's the logical point. Pascal is not saying that the individuals we meet today have the same nationality that the ones we had acquired in the past, but that they are different individuals. He's saying meeting these different individuals amounts to meeting again the French nation itself after two generations. So the question is about the use of the logical proper name, the French nation. If this expression, the French nation, is logically a proper name, then it is a term we want to be able to use at different times, on different occasions, and it would not be a proper name if we could not use it again and again to refer to the same entity. Each time we say the French nation, we mean to refer to the same entity. And since the nation we meet after two generations cannot be the same by being constituted by the same members, then what makes it the same nation? This is the question of collective identity. Now, the metaphysical point, the second point, being angry or forgetting about one's grounds for being angry are matters for moral psychology. How does a group have a moral psychology? What does it take for a being, for any kind of being, to be angry? You cannot get angry if you don't have an idea of yourself or a definition of yourself as having a definite status in the order of things, a status bringing with it various legitimate expectations on your part concerning the behavior of the rest of the world towards you. So, if a group can become angry, it means that a group has a definition of itself and that it has a collective consciousness of itself. And this will be my problem in this paper. How does a group, how can we attribute to a group a collective consciousness? So let me say a few words about the concept of a group as a moral person. This concept of moral personality attached to groups comes from the Middle Age. So I will refer for a moment to the work of Ernst Kantorowicz in his book, The King's Two Bodies. This is where he explains the origin of the concept of moral person. He says that this notion of moral personality has three sources. One is the Roman law. I will keep it aside. The second source is the theology of the church as a mystical body. I will leave that again aside. And I will concentrate on the third source, which is the philosophical notion of identity despite change. This is a notion that the medieval jurist took from the Greeks. And I will have here to go through this argument by the Greeks. The argument I am going to consider has a name in Greek philosophy. It is called the growing argument. The growing argument, that the argument of growth, in the sense in which an organism can grow. And this argument comes from the poet Epicharmus, who is a pre-Socratic thinker. Basically, we know the argument by a short quotation. Diogenes Laertius does of it in his Life of the Philosophers. And the argument is the following. Let's say we have a collection of stones. And let's say we add one stone to the marbles or small stones. Let's say we have nine stones and you add one stone to the nine stones. Would you say that this is the same number of stones? And of course, the answer is no. 10 stones is not the same number as nine stones. Okay. Now, think of, that's the argument, think of men like us the same way as you are thinking of stones. I put, one man is growing, another man is diminishing, and all men are constantly in the process of change. And since a collection of stones is not the same connection, if you add one stone or if you subtract one stone, then a man is not the same man if you add something, a little piece of matter, or if you subtract a little piece of matter. So the process of growing does not exist. What we call growth is rather the substitution of one individual to another individual, in the sense in which we substitute a collection of stone to another collection of stone by the addition of matter. This is the argument about the identity of human being. Now, for my point, what is important is that Epicharmus, this argument is better known as the argument of the ship of Theseus, the ship that you keep maintaining by replacing parts. And the question is, how is it the same ship once you have replaced all the wooden parts of the ship, since everything is new and it's the same thing? That's the problem, and that's the origin of the moral person concept. But the argument, the growing argument, is more interesting because it was put to use by Epicharmus as a poet, as the author of comedies, in his comedies. The comedies are lost, unfortunately. We don't have them, but we have quotations in Plutarch. And it's possible to reconstitute some scenes of the comedy, and this has been done by a historian, so I will quote from a British historian the following reconstitution. Suppose two characters meet on the public space, on the Agora. Let's call the first one Callias, that's the character Callias, and the second one is Coriscus. It so happens that last week, Callias has borrowed money from Coriscus. And now they meet, and they have the following exchange. Coriscus asks for being paid back, and Callias answers Coriscus by presenting to him the growing argument. Suppose you have stones, etc. And then Coriscus says, yes, I agree, it's not the same collection of stones. And then Callias, the borrower of money, says, well, look at us. I am changing all the time. So the guy who borrowed money from you does not exist anymore. This guy has disappeared. I am not the borrower of money. I am a new man. The man who borrowed money has disappeared because there has been addition to the material constitution of this person. The borrower of money does not exist, since we are different from the men who were there yesterday. Then Coriscos, the lender of money, gets very angry and he strikes Callias a blow. And Callias protests, "What are you doing?" But Coriscos tells him he has no reason to protest because the man who struck the blow does not exist anymore, has disappeared. There is nobody he could complain about. So this is the argument, and it's very important that the philosophy of identity begins in a comedy, because this comedy bears a very deep philosophical lesson to draw from it, which is there is a gap between there can be a gap between our concept of identity and our practices. Where does the comic effect of the scene come from in Epicharmus? It comes from the gap between pretense and reality, as is always in a comedy. Here, Callias, my debtor, is funny because of a discrepancy between his pretense of being motivated by a strong philosophical Heraclitean intuition, being his change, that's what he's pretending, and his real motivation, which is not to pay the money. The institution of lending and borrowing money is based on the idea that you should pay back the money you have borrowed from somebody to the very person who has lent the money to you. So the institution of lending money or borrowing money or gift or all human institutions are based on our common understanding of what it takes to be the same individual human being. And in the comedy, Callias is urging to us to make a reform of our concept of identity, and this would mean a reform of our concept of human being. But this character is comical because he still wants to be able to borrow money, but tries to make it logically impossible to pay back the money. And this is where the comedy is. So, somehow we could say that Epicharmus had already raised the principle that Quine would formulate in the 20th century, which is no entity without identity. No entity without identity. You cannot refer to human beings if you are not able to say what it takes to be the same individual human being. And what the comedy shows is that we don't say we are meeting the same human being because of any identity of its, of the material composition of this being. Matter can be a principle of individuation for distinguishing contemporary individual beings, for distinguishing one human being from another human being near it. But the material composition of a person is not the principle of individuation for identifying the person over time. And this is how growth is possible. In fact, Callias, or any living being for that matter, is like a river. And here we are back to Heraclitus, of course. We say that we bath in the same river as yesterday. Does that imply that it is the same water as yesterday? This would hold if the criterion of identity for a river was taken from the identity of the water. But suppose we were bathing in the same water. Then we would enjoy bathing not in a river, but in a lake, because a place where the water is the same is not a river, it's a lake. It's part of the definition of a river that the water is not the same. The water is flowing. It takes the flux of water to have the same river. This is the conclusion of the Greek growing argument. It explained to us that if we want to be able to speak of historical individuals, meaning by that individuals with their own history, then we have to find the identity, the diachronic identity of these individuals, not in the matter, but in something else. And in the case of the river, it's very clear that we don't take the identity of the river from the identity of the water, but we take it from the geography, from the location and the direction of the water. So, back to Kantorovich, this is where the legal thinker of Middle Age were applying a Greek argument to construe the idea of the identity despite change of moral persons such as cities, universities, churches, tribunals, or any kind of collective entity. Kantorovich quotes an argument, an interesting argument from the Glossa, which applies to the Italian city of Bologna, the capital of legal thinking in the Middle Ages, Bologna. And the argument says, the present people of Bologna is the same that it was 100 years ago. I'm quoting Kantorovich. I'm quoting the Glossa as translated by Kantorovich. The people of Bologna is the same that it was 100 years ago, even if all be dead now, who then were quick, and it's like a ship. Even if the ship has been rebuilt partly, and even if every single plank may have been replaced. So here we have the Glossa quoting the growing argument through the example of the ship of Theseus to Bologna. The identity of Bologna, it cannot be material, because if the identity were material, then each time a citizen of Bologna dies, this would mean another city. And we don't want to have a new city each time there is a new born citizen of Bologna or each time a citizen dies. And Kantorovich here makes a point about the metaphysics of collective identity as understood by these legos, and he observes that they could have spoken of the form of Bologna in the way Scottish metaphysicians would speak of the essence of Socrates. In Scottish metaphysics, what makes Socrates the individual Socrates is a form called Socratitas. Well, it is as if these legal thinkers would have us having a form of Bologna called Bononitas, the Bononitas of Bologna. Of course, the Bononitas doesn't exist, that's an invention of Kantorovich, but this was the reasoning. Since what makes Socrates the individual, the same individual during all his life is the form of Socrates, that's the Socratitas, Bologna would be the same entity during whole history because then of an individual essence called Bononitas, or if we were speaking in contemporary terms, we would not speak of individual essence or Bononitas, we would speak of the self. The self is nothing else than the individual essence of Scottish metaphysics. And there is indeed in contemporary social literature an empty way of referring to collective identities as selves, if you want, or as bononitas. We find sometimes people speaking of the British identity as Britishness. But Britishness is nothing but Britannitas. So Bolognese identity, like Bolognese sauce in the spaghetti, would be Bolognaness, I don't know, but Bononitas. And there is also mention of a Turkish identity as Turkishness. So this is Scottish metaphysics. And it's empty. Why is it empty? It's empty because, as we saw in discussing the growing argument of Epicharmus, what we need to associate with the name of an individual entity, such as Socrates or such as Bologna, what we need to associate with a proper name is a criterion of identity associating two components. We need a principle of specification, and we need a principle of individuation. For instance, if we meet Socrates, we have to meet first a human being, a man. That's the principle of specification. And then we meet not just a man, but this particular man, Socrates, the same man. And we have to take the criterion of identity for Socrates from the concept of human being. And same with a city. If we are again in Bologna, we are in a city. This is a city. But is it the same city in which we were, namely Bologna? We have to take a criterion of identity from the concept of city. Being in the same city means that we have a concept of what it takes to be the same city, and this is a concept of collective identity. So, how do we get a concept for a collective identity such as a city? Well, here I will turn first to Aristotle, then to Rousseau. First, Aristotle. As a matter of fact, Aristotle raises exactly this question at the beginning of Politics, Book 3. He connects the question, what is a city, what is the essence of a city? He connects that question of essence to the question of identity. What is it, what do we call the same city? In this beginning of Book 3, he takes the occasion of a contemporary debate among Athenians about whether they should pay back the money that was borrowed from Sparta during the time of tyranny, the 30 tyrants. Since we are now a democracy, should we pay the debt of the tyranny? Are we the same city? That was a legal problem, exactly like the problems that the medieval legal jurists were trying to solve through the concept of moral personality. Should we pay back the debts of the ancient regime? That's the problem. After a revolution, this problem arises everywhere. And Aristotle sees here that we need to associate to the name of the city a criterion of identity. He writes exactly this sentence. What is the principle on which we ought to pronounce a city to be the same, or not the same, but a different city? This is the question of the identity of a city. And as always in Aristotle, he tries first several proposals, several attempts at a definition, and rejects them and corrects them. The first one is the idea that the same being the same city is being a city at the same place, location. And here, he makes two objections. First objection is that you could take the Peloponnesus and build a wall around the Peloponnese, where there were at that time several cities, and that does not make this part of Greece one and the same city. But there is another objection, more interesting. He quotes Herodotus, the historian Herodotus, saying that when Babylon, the town of Babylon, was captured, a considerable part of the city was not aware of it 3 days later. There was an army invading one part of Babylon, and at the other end of Babylon, people did not know what was happening at the other part. They were not aware of the invasion. So, says Aristotle, Babylon is not a polis, it's not a political entity, because in a political entity, people would know what happens to the city. In Babylon, people were not interested in what is happening at the other side of the town. That means that it was not a polis, it was an ethnos. That's the opposition between polis, political community, and ethnos, just people. And so, location is not the criterion of identity for a polis. Then Aristotle tries the definition by the identity of the members, and he rejects the proposal because the same city, we have the same city with the new members, And he says there that a city is like a river. There is always a new water, but precisely the river is still in place because the river is renewing its composition. So, composition is not the criterion. Then, the idea is that a city is the same if it has the same politeia. And politeia is a word we translate by constitution. Being the same city is having the same constitution. And this is what was lacking in Babylon, in the ancient times. In Babylon, people were not thinking of the town of Babylon as having a constitution, a politeia. Now, what did Aristotle, what was he calling politeia? Let's say, was Aristotle already defending the idea of a constitutional patriotism in the sense of Habermas? Is that the idea? For us, constitution is just one part of law. It's a part of law which organizes the political powers in a country. And we have experts on constitution law discussing constitutional matters, such as what is the character of the political regime? Is it presidential? Is it parliamentary? What are the rights of the judiciary? All kinds of very specialized questions. Now, a politeia in Greek sense and in Aristotle's sense is something much more broader. It's very broad. And it includes actually all the institutions, all the social institutions of the people. In Politics Book 7, Aristotle explains a little what he means by politeia by making some comparisons between various cities around the Mediterranean. And he says that in each city, the citizens are trying to achieve something by their politeia. What they are trying to achieve is their local idea of what it takes to be excellent, what it takes to be an accomplished human being. What is eudaimonia? What is happiness in the sense of being an accomplished human being? What is excellence? What is arete? But, says Aristotle, the politeia, the various constitutions are different. That means that people don't have the same idea of excellence. And what is expressed in the politeia of a city is the idea of excellence. This is something you would not find in contemporary discussion about constitutional law, and even it's the opposite of the patriotism of constitution that Habermas is advocating, because Habermas would ask us to separate question of eudaimonia, happiness, excellence, and questions of legal validity of the constitution. In Book 7 of Politics, Aristotle gives some examples, and maybe I quote one of them. He mentioned a custom among a tribe, which is the following. At the festival where men are gathering together, only a few of them are allowed to drink from the cup. In order to drink from the cup, first, only the men are there, and then among these men, only the men who have fought in battles and killed a lot of enemies can drink from the cup. But if you have not killed anybody, you are not really a man, and you don't drink from the cup. And says Aristotle, this is part of the politeia of these people. So, in a politeia is embodied an idea, a collective idea of what we should be. And of course, Aristotle is not saying that these guys had a good politeia. He says that a good politeia is not intended to domination and war against the other. But still, a politeia means the embodiment, the collective embodiment of an idea of happiness. And I would argue that, I would propose that his definition of idea is very close to what we would call cultural identity. Constitutional identity in the sense of Aristotle is cultural identity. Now, maybe you could think that this is an old-fashioned Greek conception and it's part of the ancient times and it's no longer relevant to us. But here is just a reference to Montesquieu in The Spirit of Laws, book 11, chapter 5. And there he says, all states, all governments have a general end and a particular end. The end of all the states, all the constitutions, is self-preservation, maintaining itself in existence. So that's general. But he says each of them has a particular object. And he gives example. You take Rome, the Empire of Rome. The object is increase of domination. That's the object of the state. Sparta, the object is war. Jewish people, that's religion. Other people, that commerce. Other people, in China, the idea is public tranquility. So he has exactly the same idea of the constitution as Aristotle. There is not just the rules, there is a finality, there is a telos, there is an object. And this is an important idea that I will now I will say just a few words about Rousseau as having reproduced somehow this distinction between politeia in the restricted sense and politeia in the broader sense. In Rousseau, we meet the very question of a moral psychology for a collective body, for a collective entity, since Rousseau is the philosopher of general will, la volonté générale. And an entity with a collective will certainly has a moral psychology. Here, such an entity has a collective consciousness. And we could ask how that is possible. And Rousseau gave us actually two accounts of the possibility for an individual being to say we want, since general will is the possibility of saying we want. There is a general will if I can say we want, meaning by that there are other people with me. And if there has to be something like a general will, we have to give an account of this possibility of saying we want. Rousseau gave two accounts. You find the first account in the Contrat Social, book 1, and this is an account where Rousseau speaks as a political philosopher. But there is, fortunately, a second account where he speaks, as Durkheim said, as a sociologist. And the second account is the real one. The first account in book 1 is the account where the very possibility of saying we want is the result of the social contract. In the social contract, individual people are supposed to come together and to renounce simultaneously their individual will in order to replace it by the general will. The general will is supposed to be the result of this process of gathering together and agreeing on the terms of the social contract. But, I will not consider here some of the objections, but just one. The main objection to the account Rousseau gives in the first book of the social contract is that he has put the cart before the horse. He has made what is called a hysteron proteron, taken things in the wrong way, in the wrong direction. Since the result of the social contract is supposed to be that now we can say we want, But in order to agree on the terms of the social contract, we have to be able to say we want. So the we want that we are supposed to achieve by going through the process of the social contract, this we want, this possibility of saying we want, has to be there before. Otherwise, there will be no gathering and no agreement on the very language in which we are going to produce our social contract. So, if we had only the abstract legal account that we find in Book One, Rousseau would not have given any explanation of the very possibility for one person to say, we want. Fortunately, there is another account that I will refer to now, and it's in Book Two of the same treatise, the social contract. The mistake Rousseau is making, the mistake of putting the cart before the horse in Book One, comes from the fact that he is somehow figuring or representing the collective body as an assembly of people, of individual people, meeting together and producing the agreement. So it's supposed to take place between contemporary people, actual people, agreeing on the same terms of the contract. But the question we have to ask here is that what makes this collection of people a constitutional assembly? How could individuals meeting together turn themselves into a constitutional power? Where does their authority come from? But as we are going to see, Rousseau was aware of that, and he was aware of the necessity to ground the constitutional power of the assembly we find in Book One into something else, which I will call an instituting power. And this instituting power we find in Book Two. And we find it with the extraordinary character of the legislator, the legislator. This extraordinary character has no authority, but he's an extraordinary wise man, and since people know that he's wise, they go to him and they ask him to lay down the rules for them. So this is a paradox. When people want to have a constitution, they cannot produce the constitution themselves. They have to go to the legislator. But, says Rousseau in chapter 7, the legislator cannot work. He cannot give them the constitution. And the reason is the following, I quote, for a young people, he means a new people, for young people to be able to relish sound principles of political theory and follow the fundamental rules of statecraft, the effect would have to become the chaos. So this thing, this is the cart before the horse. The effect should become the cause. And he continues, I quote, the social spirit which should be created by these institutions would have to preside over their very foundation. Men would have to be before law what they should become by means of law. There is a circle. These people need law. Since they need law, they are not able to understand the rationale of the constitution that the legislator has prepared for them. So only if they were able to understand the constitution could they accept it. But precisely, if they were able to understand it, they would have already a constitution. If you don't have a constitution, you cannot understand matters of constitution. And this is how nobody can produce a constitution from scratch, since without a constitution, you cannot lay down a constitution. The cause would have to become the effect. And you know the solution of Rousseau. Since the social spirit is not there at the beginning, the legislator will turn himself into a religious character with supernatural powers, and he would make believe that he's sent by the gods and impose the legislation on the people. But of course, that's a trick. That's just a trick. And this trick means only that Rousseau has seen the gap between the early situation in which he has just independent individuals and the resulting situation he wants to achieve with social beings. Rousseau sees that it's impossible to go from the state of nature to the state of civil society just by a consensus of wills, because people are not ready. Individual people in the state of nature are not in a, don't have the capacity for self-legislation. Now, this circle is a vicious one if we stay with the notion of an instantaneous self-positive entity, the assembly of people, who have to turn themselves here and now into a constitutional state. But if you add the idea of paideia, I mean by that education, then we are no longer with an instantaneous entity, we are with a temporal entity, with a history, and here the vicious circle becomes a virtuous circle. We can understand how a people can have a constitution. And this is something Rousseau points out in Book 3 of the Social Contract, Chapter 12. That's a chapter about the division of laws, how many types of laws. And he says, you have political laws, that's the constitution, you have civil laws about property and things like that, and you have criminal laws. That makes three divisions. But he says, there is a fourth class of law, which is the most important one, but this fourth category of laws is not about laws that you would find in the constitution, in the legislation, in the written legislation. These laws are in the hearts of people. I quote, along with these three kinds of law goes a fourth, most important of all, which is not written on tablets of marble or brass, but on the hearts of the citizens. This forms the real constitution of the state, the real constitution. The real constitution is not in the written text, the real constitution is in the hearts. This is what I would call, with Castoriadis, by the way, the instituting power behind the constitutional power. In the hearts of the people, the real constitution of the state, I continue, I am speaking of morality, of customs. I'm speaking of manners and morals, les manières et les mœurs. So here again, we have the politeia grounded into the paideia. We have this broad notion of politeia, which includes paideia. So I would say that Rousseau was aware that the criteria of identity for a collective body are to be taken from the self-consciousness of the citizens of the political community, which means that what do they take themselves as being, as a community? So it has to be taken from their politeia, but the real politeia is the paideia. So it's not enough to look at the written text of the constitution. You have to look at the paideia, which is the practices, the customs, the morals of the people. So what did I do in this paper? I conclude. First, I have put aside questions about social identities, and I have concentrated on the notion of collective identity. Namely, the question whether a particular group is the same or is a different group from a former one. And I have tried to spell out the connection between being and identity through a repetition of the growing argument of Greek philosophy. Growing argument shows us that we cannot understand what it is to be a human being if we don't understand what it is to be the same human being. Being and identity are connected. But groups, collective entity, have an identity because they have an individuality. And I have turned to Rousseau in order to show how the criteria of identity for a political community have to be taken, have to be drawn from the collective consciousness, in the sociological sense of Durkheim, collective consciousness of the people, a collective consciousness that we should not take only in a linguistic form, but that we should find in the instituting power as exercise in a form of a paideia, education. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Professor Beckham, for your detailed and very well elaborated lecture. I think we can open the floor and have a discussion. So your questions, you're welcome to ask your questions. So Milena Yakimova.
I have a sort of parochial question, but all the examples that you gave were quite relational. And the collective identity construction that you suggested us was, I would say, entitarian. But this guy was asked to return his money back. I mean, isn't entity a sort of a moment of a relation? Or is it entity, so to say, individually pre-given, pre-instituted as an entity before entering a relation? And the second point, well, isn't there a difference between the French nation, for example, and my favorite Bulgarian football team, as to collective identity? I understand. I am asking here you to elaborate what you already have, I'm sure, but the time is quite short. Telling everything. Thank you.
Okay, the first question is whether these identities, in the example of the comedy where one character is trying not to pay back the money, is the identity pre-given, which means not conventional, or is it some product of the institution? Is that the question?
In both of the examples, the identity was recollected because it was asked to revert to oneself. To have a self means to revert to oneself. Can you revert to yourself without the gaze of something outside you? I ask you to bring my money back, and you are asking me to be responsible for my being a self. My entity is brought about it in that very moment. Of course, there are much more things and difficulties, but let's make the long story short.
Yeah. So my examples were relational because I tried to get real examples of questions of identity, and of course legal matters such as who should pay money to whom in the case of individuals, or what entity can claim to have a moral personality? Because in the Middle Ages, that was exactly the same question of money. A collective entity, such as a city, could borrow money. And the question was precisely, who should pay back the money? Who should pay back the money? Is it the city, or is it the citizens? Suppose I have lent money to a city and I am not paid back, could I ask the citizen to pay me back? So these questions were real questions by jurists and legal persons, and that's why they are relational. But What is interesting is that in these questions, we take for granted that the various parts in these conflicts, the various parts have criteria of identity. And what is interesting is that you cannot just speculate in a philosophical way about criteria of identity. You have to you have to see that your criteria of identity are compatible with the institutions. Otherwise, you have to change the institutions. What is comical in Epicharmus is that nothing is changed in the institutions, but there is one character who wants to change the criteria for human identity. And of course, it's not possible, because at that time, if you don't change the whole set of institutions, then life is no longer possible. Maybe I quote another example, comic example, which is no longer a question of paying back money. There is a comic scene by Epicharmus, and this is a person who has invited friends to come to dinner. So suppose you are invited to dinner, and you go to the person, the inviting person, and at the door opens, and the guy who has invited you says, "No, no, who are you? I did not invite you because you don't have the same body. Your body is different from the body I invited." So then the new criterion of identity, the material criterion of identity, which was offered by some philosophers in Greek philosophy, the new criterion of identity made it impossible to invite people or to marry people. Life would be impossible with these new criteria unless you would rewrite completely the whole set of human institutions. So these examples were intended to show how deep in our practices are grounded the criteria of identity. That's what is behind the relational part. Now, maybe the second question, a very important one, and of course I could not enter into that, but intentionally I gave a list of examples with very different kinds of collective entities, and I did not want to focus just on the term nation, which at the time of Pascal did not have the same exactly the same connotation. I would say any collective entity has to be defined by the criteria of identity we would use to naming this kind of entity. So in the case of a football team, what do we require a team to continue to bear the name we used to have for the former team? So can a team replace all the members? What are the changes we allow for the same team? What kind of history do we understand for a football team? And of course, the history of a football team, or the history of a music quartet, or the history of a university, requires very different criteria of identity. But in the case of a nation, according to Aristotle, a political entity, let's say, it's not just us who have to provide the criterion of identity. We want the people themselves to provide the criteria. What do you require yourself to be the same political entity? That's the question. And this is how, somehow, it's a matter of self-consciousness and democracy.
Thank you. As far as I could understand, the main motive in your lecture. It is constructed on the idea that on the logics that the identity should necessarily be posited. The collective identity is needed if we have to have the form of the constitution, then it is necessary to presuppose some spirit of the nation, some collective identity preceding the form of constitution, for example. But I will ask you a general logical question. The anti-essentialist turn in philosophy of language makes this logics of assumption of identity very very problematic. I mean, two general arguments, one by Quine and the other by Wittgenstein, that reject the possibility of tautology in practice. I mean, the first dogma of empiricism of Quine, the impossibility of analytic sentences, the impossibility of the sameness of identity. And so the same argument nearly is could be the same argument appears in 333, I think, in the Tractatus. The function can never be its own argument. And after this very strong and critical statements, I think we have two possibilities. One of them is to say that identity in se, pure identity, sameness, does not exist in practice at all. I think that the later Wittgenstein is near to this idea. Not so clearly, of course, not so simply. The other general possibility is to say that even in the practice, identity is impossible. We have to presuppose it. And this second possibility presses us to think that there is something as essence that is always hidden, always inaccessible. And with this second possibility, we repeat the general metaphysical gesture of presupposing transcendent instance. Thank you.
Okay, that's a very important question. Essentialism. Essentialism. And thank you for the question, because then I will clarify one important point. Starting from the end of the what you said, I would say that the two possibilities you were referring to represent the philosophy of identity before Wittgenstein, before analytic philosophy, let's say. Namely, there are no identities, or there are identities, but we can't apprehend them, they escape. We presuppose that there is identity, but we cannot establish identity. So the no identity, that's Epicharmus, that's Heraclitus. And there is identity, but we cannot grasp it, comes to the same somehow. Now, what is important is the very notion of criterion of identity comes from Wittgenstein. This is a Wittgensteinian notion, and I would be ready to argue that this is one of the most important points in Wittgenstein, that you cannot use a term with a claim to be a referential term without a criterion of identity. Because when you suppose you assign a name, a proper name to an entity, it is a condition for the object having received a name that we are able to call again this object by the same name in the future. So there has to be a rule for identifying again and again the entity. So it's a very Wittgensteinian notion, and it's important to see how it has nothing to do with essentialism as we knew it before. Actually, in the paper, but very briefly, I made an allusion to essentialism with this example of Bologna. The example that is in Kantorowicz, he was putting together the thinking of these legal experts in the Middle Age, and saying that what was at that time they were thinking of identity as a fiction, as a legal fiction, in order to be able to assign claims, rights, problem of legacy, who has a right on something, transmission of properties, things like that, to moral persons. So they were dealing with fictions. So they were not afraid of essentialists because these essences were conventional. But this was pure essentialism. And the example of explaining the history of Bologna as the history of the same city by the Bononitas of Bologna is clearly empty, saying that this is the same city because there is an essence of Bologna, and this essence of Bologna is Bononitas. And as soon as you have Bononitas, you are the same city as Bologna, is no explanation at all. So this is the empty essentialist that we don't want anymore. So we essentialist is now dead. But Quine and Wittgenstein did not think of identity as bringing with it necessarily essentialism. Since who said no entity without an entity? That's Quine. No entity without an entity. I cannot have an ontological commitment to an entity if I am not able to provide you with a criterion for saying whether this entity I am referring to is the same as the one I gave a name earlier, or if it's a different one. And as you know, this is the ground for Quine to reject possible individuals, possible worlds, possible entities, because possible entities cannot be individuated, since there are no criterion of identity for distinguishing one possible man from another possible man. They are too general to be distinguished by a criterion of identity. So no ontological commitments without criterion of identity. And in sociology, if you apply to sociology this Quinean principle, it means that if you don't have criteria of identity for various groups, football teams, colleges, cities, nations, etc., then you are a nominalist. You don't want to have any ontological commitments to groups. And so you are, if you don't want collective identity, your sociology is nominalistic. It's a sociology without groups, which is kind of a paradox. For me, it's a paradox, but I would say most of the sociologists of today want a sociology without groups because they don't want ontological commitments to groups. And that's their problem. But certainly, in my school of the school of sociology I favor, that's Durkheim, there is a commitment, ontological commitment, to the existence of groups, which means that we have to be able to identify the same group over time.
Thank you very much for the very illuminating lecture. I would like to ask just two short questions. And the first one is emerging from this lecture of yours, and also from this chapter, which was attached to us by the Foundation for Humanitarian and Social Studies. It was again on collective identity with a focus on Hegel, Montesquieu, and Searle. And perhaps the question is a little bit out of the frames you put in this investigation, But I'm very much interested because you never mention a concept like collective memory, speaking of collective identity. So, as if there is no such concept. So, of course, this is a very contested concept. It's very debatable and very debated. But still, you are not using it at all, either affirmative or criticizing it. So, what's your notion on the concept of collective identity? It emerged by the French tradition, as far as I know, in social and humanitarian studies. And my second short question, I haven't got at all an answer of it, but it was when you spoke about the metaphysical, let's say, the metaphysics of collective identity, and there was a very illuminating paragraph about this ness suffix. What does British ness mean, Turkish ness, Bulgarian ness, or whatever ness? It was, so you said it's quite metaphysical, ergo empty. But language has many such suffixes in many and many such languages. For instance, the German Kait, let's say, or all those isms that are giving names to epochs, to trends, to everything. So these suffixes are a kind of a language tool, just to summarize and to make some abstract notion, some I wouldn't say a concept, but it always go in this direction. So what is the thin border, perhaps, between the language tool, its work as abstracting and summarizing, the metaphysics, and emptiness? This is a very, let's say, a very dangerous path, a very great one. I haven't got any of the possible answers. Thank you.
Okay. So first point about collective memory. Actually, there was a small hint of a possible development about collective memory in my quotation of Pascal, because Pascal is saying that Pascal is mentioning, let's say, a British citizen meeting French people, the French guys, and he's turning that into a metaphor for the change of our feelings. And I said this raises an important question, which is whether it makes sense to personify a group and to assign to a group a collective memory. So your question is very much welcome to the topic. I would say just one thing. There is a debate everywhere, but also among my colleagues in Paris, about the distinction between history and memory. For instance, in France, we have debates about whether the parliament should pass memorial laws, you know, laws forbidding certain opinions about crimes in the past. And of course, my historian colleagues are very aware of the distinction between what is collective memory in this sense and what they are doing, history. The representation which is supposed to be the memory of the people and the representation which they give as scientific history. But I would say this is not the most important debate to have. This debate is not really about memory, it's about democracy. The real debate should be about Alvax and Durkheimian sociologists discussing the way what they would call a collective memory is materialized. Where is it? Where is it? So where should we look in order to say this is the collective memory of these people? Is it in the narrations, some oral narratives, you know, folklore? Is it in the monument? Well, what is the form? What is the standard form for a collective consciousness in the when it comes to memory? But I would agree that it's a very difficult concept because collective memory has a tendency to disappear and then to come back again. And if you think of, I was always struck by an example that I will just mention. It was in the New York Review of Books, an article, a recension of an Irish book. And this Irish writer, was telling us that there is a valley in Ireland, and at the center of the valley there is a beautiful, more than a farm, let's say, a manor, a castle, a very well building, with people who took this building in the 17th century. And on the hills, you have poor families, and these families are there, and all the time they look at their farm, and they wait for the time they will come back to their home. Yeah, you see, so collective memory can be a lasting thing in some situation, and a very, very deep one on the side of feelings and claims and question of recognition of past events. So it's a very important thing, but somehow people, as Pascal says, they can also forget, and so the collective memory disappears. But how does it come that it reappears? Is it just the work of agitators, you know, manipulators, or is it something which is to explain by other principles? This is an important question. I would just say that sociology cannot work without some notion of a collective memory. Now, on the question of emptiness, well, why is it empty to explain the distinctiveness of Great Britain by Britishness? It's because Britishness does not add anything to the sentence. They are distinct. They are not. They have something distinctive, and we just put a name on this distinction by the abstract form. Britishness, or in other languages, it would be there are other way of forming an abstract notion, and this is pure Platonism. To kalon, that the something is beautiful because of the beauty, that's the explanation, and it's empty because it leaves out the material component of these entities, which have to be the same over time. Kantorowicz makes a very good point about that. He says that these medieval jurists were, in fact, compared